whatever our responsibilities are in the region, we can't reasonably deal with them if that basic distinction between who's an immigrant and who's a refugee and where we draw the line gets lost track of. And I think that's what has happened. And that blurring of the line, I don't think is accidental. I think that's been part of an effort by political activists to promote, to weaken borders and to promote migration generally of immigrants and refugees, both.
I agree. In fact, I have a new article about how political correctness impedes our ability to reform immigration, that they use language in such a way that it blurs distinctions and you can't have an honest dialogue about the problem.
It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
Immigration. For more than a month now, we've heard on the news almost nonstop about the migrant caravan from Central America, and it's here. Mexico and the U.S. are dealing with the problems associated with thousands of mostly Honduran migrants who want to live in the United States. It is costing us plenty to keep them out. They're not refugees in the sense that with refugees, the nation invites people to the U.S. for various reasons. These migrants are not invited. They are individuals who are seeking political asylum. And under our laws, a foreign national that is seeking protection using the political asylum laws has to have a well-founded fear of persecution based on religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or public opinion. The vast majority of Central American applicants would not be allowed to remain in the U.S. based on what has happened in the past when they have applied. Most of them say they are fleeing gang violence, domestic abuse, poverty, and they want job opportunities. Even though we in America are compassionate people, fleeing gang violence and domestic abuse, poverty, and more opportunities, that's not part of the criteria that our government uses when making decisions about which people to admit as asylees. And so the vast majority of Central American applicants would be denied entry into the U.S. to remain. And that's part of the problem that President Trump has had. And that is why he made the decision to force them to apply at ports of entry outside the country rather than allowing them to come into the nation, make the application in the U.S. and stay maybe for years while their cases are pending before a federal judge. Joining me today to make sense of the issue is Professor Peter Scarry, Professor of Political Science at Boston College. Peter is an expert on immigration, race relations, and social policy. He's also a contributor to my new edited volume, Debating Immigration, the second edition. Debating Immigration has 20 unique essays on different aspects of immigration in the U.S. and Europe. So let's welcome Peter to the Be the People show on the America Out Loud Network.
Hi, Carol. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm so pleased to have you on the show.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
So it's been a while since we've spoken, and certainly not since the caravan has arrived at our southern border. I'd like to know your thoughts about how we got to that point. Is there anything that the U.S. government could have done to avoid the caravan coming in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. It's something I've been asking myself over the last several weeks as well, and I'm not sure that there was much in the sense that my thoughts are that the caravan reflects the efforts of some groups of people. It's not clear who. We haven't been given a lot of information by the media, but it seems pretty clear to me that the caravan is not a one-off event. We obviously had one like this back in the spring, and there were previous caravans in previous years. I think this reflects the efforts not just of individual people who are struggling and who are coming up here because they feel that they need work or they're trying to find relatives, or they may have some solid grounds for asylum. I think it's a complicated question, but it reflects more than their own individual desires and goals. I think this reflects a pretty clear effort of political activists to force the hand of the Trump administration. I don't think it's any accident that this caravan was launched in the fall, for example. Most of the caravans that I'm aware of previously came up in the spring, which is a much more typical, reasonable time for people to move from the south to the north following either harvest or better weather. The timing of this is rather interesting. But bottom line, I think it reflects a pretty clear political strategy on the part of activists who were trying to provoke a response.
Let me ask you this. What happened with the previous caravans? Because they didn't get the kind of media attention that this one did this fall.
You're right. I wish I knew more that I could, about all those previous ones myself. The one in the spring I followed somewhat carefully, and that did get more attention than previous ones. And again, I think it got more attention partly because the media were more attuned, because it was they have a beat on immigration now vis-a-vis the Trump administration. That springtime caravan, spring of 2018, had many fewer people and got less attention than this one did. And I can't give you specific numbers, but they obviously posed a big challenge to be processed. That was part of the controversy over the separation of children from parents.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I had not even connected the two, because all we heard about was the children and the parents.
Right. And obviously that was, I don't think anyone believes that was a success for the Trump administration. I don't even think the Trump administration thinks that. I don't know. I haven't been in touch with them. But it obviously, I think, fueled the fires of the organizers of the of that caravan, who by the way, back in the spring, were more willing to declare their leadership of it. There's a group called Pueblo Sin Fronteras, People Without Borders.
Yes.
That was explicitly claiming credit for that. It's been interesting to see how they haven't explicitly claimed credit for this caravan, although it seems pretty clear from press reports they have people on the scene in the caravan itself. So my hunch is that they are involved pretty seriously in the leadership of this effort as well.
So it seems to me that in the spring, that caravan, the migrants were admitted to the U.S., and because of the public pressure, they were processed, and they probably are still here in this country waiting for their cases to be heard. And that probably fueled the second caravan, because if one caravan gets admitted, why wouldn't you just keep sending people until the nation said no?
Yeah, except that what people in that first caravan last spring endured in terms of getting separated from their kids, the attention that they got. I don't think the individuals in that caravan wound up feeling in general that they were successful. I wouldn't think. But I think what your question makes me think about is how the motives of individuals are one thing. The motives of the people who organized and try to sustain this mass movement of people, that's another thing. And I wish that more attention were paid to that, because it seems to me we're now in a situation where whatever the motives of the individuals are and whatever their own goals are in terms of whether they're trying to reunite families or they have genuine concerns about for their safety and want to make genuine asylum claims, which would then have to be adjudicated, I think that's different from what's driving the people who are organizing this caravan.
But we don't
spend much time talking about that. We're sort of focusing. I don't mean you and me. I mean in the public arena, we're much more preoccupied with the individuals. And while their claims, whether legitimate or not, that should be scrutinized. But it's part of a bigger political effort, I think, and I think we ought to pay attention to that.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a very effective manipulation, because Americans are compassionate, and especially, I know the church world pretty well. It's pretty easy to manipulate the public with the pictures of women and children, children being separated from their parents. It was my understanding, though, that after the public pressure, the president united, after 20 days, the child has to be united with the parents, and then they have to have accommodations up to a certain standard. And I thought that some of those people might still be in the U.S. pending their cases.
Well, I can't say for sure. I haven't followed the evidence as carefully as I'd like to, but I think it's also pretty clear that a fair number of those separations between of the parents from the children, they haven't all been rectified, and I think that there are still a fair number of children who haven't made it back to their parents. They got lost in the system. I don't know for sure. It's a complicated story, but I don't. There may well be, and certainly in the past, it's true that when asylee claimants have come here, they have blended into the social fabric and haven't always reported back for their court dates. I'm sure some of that has gone on with the last caravan. My sense is, however, that it's also been at the cost of a fair number of family separations that I don't think have all been, rectified. But that's the legacy of a policy that was, I personally don't support the administration's family separation policy. But at the same time, I think they were provoked into it by these kinds of caravan stratagems, if you will, and it's definitely a two-sided dance,
right?
And the people who have organized this, I think, deserve considerable responsibility for the outcomes as well.
I think I read that there are about 5,000 children still in custody, but part of the problem too is that sometimes the people in the caravans have children that don't belong to them, and if the government can't, prove that a child belongs to a particular individual, I guess they're certainly not going to hand them over to someone that they're not sure is the parent.
That's true too. I don't know what the specific numbers are, but I have no doubt that those kinds of things have arisen. We're talking about large numbers of people who, for whatever reasons, feel desperate and will go through all sorts of stratagems to achieve their goals, and it gets pretty complicated when we're trying to make sense of that or intervene in that kind of situation. These are difficult questions. I don't think any of these kinds of judgments that have to be made are easy.
Well, we're going to take a brief break, and when I return, I'd like to talk about how the numbers have escalated between 2018 in the number of people who asked for political asylum.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Are you wondering what we can do about immigration? Then get your copy of my newly released book, Debating Immigration, the second edition, available at Amazon, Cambridge University Press, and all major booksellers. I'm back with my guest, Peter Scarry of Boston College, and we're discussing immigration. Peter, have you followed the numbers? I believe in 2009, there were 5,000 people that asked for asylum, and by 2016 or 2017, that was up to 94,000.
Are you talking about from Central America, or are you talking about overall?
I think you're talking about Central America. I believe I'm talking about Central America. And I remember reading an article saying that someone had taught them the magic words, that they knew that if they said asylum, it came with all of these rights and privileges. And even that lady that held up in the church many years ago, Elvira Arellano or something like that, she came back to the U.S., you know, for the third or fourth time, and she got political asylum, or at least she applied for it.
Let me try to answer your question this way. I'm of the opinion that we in the United States have some responsibility for the situation in Central America today. We have a long history there. We have most recently much of the controversy and the activist movement obviously stems from the Reagan years and the civil wars in Central America, when we supported the anti-communist side in these various different countries there, our own drug habits and our drug policies that have affected the flow of drugs through that part of the world. I mean, even General Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, when he was the head of the Central Command, which was responsible for Central America and that part of the world, even he wrote articles to the effect that he thought we had some responsibility there as a nation. That doesn't get much attention these days. So I do think we have some fingerprints on this. That, however, in my mind, doesn't mean a blank check that we can just simply open our borders to all these thousands of people who want to come up here. I think some of them have legitimate claims as asylees. And I think we have, like I said, some responsibility that we should scrutinize their claims very carefully and be mindful of our own responsibilities in the region. But having said that, I think it's also true that, like I said before, there are efforts to organize this kind of movement. There are clear efforts to encourage people to come up from Central America who don't have legitimate claims, it seems to me, that large sectors in the media in the United States and among the public generally, certainly among my students at Boston College, don't really want to make very clear distinctions between ordinary immigrants who seek to come here for, you know, reasons of making a better living or improving their lives versus people who have legitimate refugee claims. That distinction has gotten thoroughly blurred in the public debate and in the public consciousness. And whatever our responsibilities are in the region, we can't reasonably deal with them if that basic distinction between who's an immigrant and who's a refugee and where we draw the line gets lost track of. And I think that's what has happened. And that blurring of the line, I don't think is accidental. I think that's been part of an effort by political activists to promote, to weaken borders and to promote migration generally of immigrants and refugees, both.
I agree. In fact, I have a new article about how political correctness impedes our ability to reform immigration, that they use language in such a way that it blurs distinctions and you can't have an honest dialogue about the problem.
It's certainly not easy. And it's gotten increasingly difficult, I'm afraid.
Well, let's shift over to the immigration problem more broadly. Do you think President Trump will have more success than previous presidents when it comes to reforming some of the bigger issues? We know that he has even threatened to sign an executive order ending birthright citizenship, which we know would push it to the Supreme Court. The court would have to act, but do you believe that he will have some success because he is trying to enforce some laws?
Yeah, I guess I'm dubious, Carol. I'm not very enthusiastic about President Trump's approach to these problems. I would say that. That I am sympathetic to the many Americans who respond to his policies, because I feel strongly that the concerns of large numbers of ordinary Americans about increasing levels of immigration, whether legal or illegal, were so ignored for so long and so denigrated for so long by our political elites of both parties, that I understand why so many Americans would respond to somebody like President Trump. But I have a hard time endorsing his policies or his approach, I'm afraid. I think his divisiveness and even his policies are not going to advance us very, very far, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, my issue is that a lot of the things that President Trump has been accused of, it was the exact same things that President Obama did and maybe previous presidents, but no one said a word. The media didn't care, such as the tear gas. I read one report where it had been tear gas had been deployed many times on the border by President Obama and other presidents, too, because it's not unusual for migrants to rush the border, to rush the ports of entry.
Right. And in fact, there were incidents where civilians were killed. One civilian, at least, was killed by Marines who were deployed at the border along the Rio Grande in Texas under the Clinton administration. You're right, but I guess I'd have to say President Trump has, I would argue, brought that kind of reaction upon himself by his overheated and sometimes offensive rhetoric. Yeah, he's he's drawn that to himself, and I think he thrives on it. So I don't think that's good for us as a nation, but I find it difficult to criticize his critics when I think he's fueling them and feeding off of them. And that's why I fear that, well, some of the things he has asserted about immigration, again, while greatly, I would say, exaggerated and often put very offensively, they resonate with a lot of people because the alternative rhetoric that was heard for the last 25 or 30 years just didn't correspond to reality for a lot of people.
Well, you know, in our volume, there's so many essays about different aspects of immigration, but
right.
We have not had a major immigration reform bill since 1986, and, you know, we've come close for a few times. Congress doesn't seem to have any incentive to reform immigration, and I'm wondering if President Trump's actions will light a fire under Congress, because as long as Congress isn't willing to reform immigration, the executive, whether it's President Obama, Trump, or the next president, they will unilaterally try to reform it.
I guess I'm not as sanguine as it sounds as you are. I don't know that Republicans are going to grab onto this very very straightforwardly. They don't seem to have up to now. They've sort of allowed the president to take the lead. Democrats aren't going to be there, and things aren't going to happen in the House after January 20th. I don't see that happening, and I don't know what constructive policies President Trump is proposing. I mean, the wall. Let's talk about the wall for a moment, okay? The wall is what he seems to be most fixed on for a long time, and I understand why, because it's a symbol. But the fact is,
and it's also a campaign promise.
Well, it is a campaign promise, but the wall is really only one. It's a symbol of what has to be a much more full-throated policy that he doesn't spend much time talking about. He doesn't spend much time talking about employer sanctions, putting real penalties in place that would really penalize the employers who hire undocumented immigrants. That's as important, if not more important, than the wall. But then that, of course, requires government bureaucracies and penalties of the sort that businesses don't often like imposed on them. But I would argue this is a case where the public good requires a government bureaucracy to impose restrictions and penalties on private enterprise.
I blame Congress, because it seems to me that if Democrats and Republicans were doing what we elected them to do, they would come up with the immigration plan that addressed some of those issues that we know are important.
I agree. Congress has reneged on its responsibilities in lots of policy areas. That's a more systemic problem in our politics these days. But it's also true that immigration is a really difficult issue. There's a lot of interest at play. And even though the rhetoric about us being a country of immigrants, which is true, it complicates the issue even more, because so many Americans feel so strongly that they owe something to America and to future generations of immigrants. And a lot of Americans don't see it that way, but certainly a lot of Americans trace their immigrant heritage back and decide that this means we have to welcome untold numbers of future immigrants. I don't necessarily agree with that, but it's an important part of the mix. And I don't see any easy way out of this. I mean, again, I'm afraid that the environment we're in right now doesn't promise to provide a way out, at least not in my opinion.
Well, Peter, this is the Be the People show, so you can't lead the show without offering some constructive suggestions on what everyday people can do to make a difference in this area.
Okay, that's fair enough. I don't want to leave things in a state of policy nihilism or something. I agree. So one thing that I think we could do, but also that our established institutions and indeed our government could do, that would be very beneficial, I think, in this current environment, would be to really get serious about teaching immigrants English. I don't know about you, Carol, but I haven't met too many immigrants who don't want to learn English if they have the opportunity. But we don't do a very good job of encouraging immigrants to learn English. We don't do a very good job with ESL programs. They're underfunded. They're not structured very well. And if we were serious and undertook a major national campaign to teach immigrants English, I think that would have two very beneficial effects.
But wait a minute. One, that would be politically incorrect, because aren't we supposed to let them celebrate their unique culture here? Wouldn't the left be all over that?
Well, if the left would be all over that, I think that would be an argument that would really be worth having, okay? Because I don't think ordinary immigrants feel that way. I think many of their leaders might make a kind of multicultural argument, but I think immigrants in their daily lives understand better that English is something that is very valuable to them.
I agree. And you know something? A lot of us, when we're shopping or we're in stores and we try to speak to someone and they're not speaking English, I mean, that is a public safety problem.
It can be, and that speaks to the other side of the equation, why I think this might be a good idea, because it would also send an important signal to large numbers of Americans who aren't immigrants, who have been told now for 20 or years or more that, you know, they are becoming a minority, that we're becoming a majority minority society, and that's not a message that large numbers of ordinary Americans, especially I guess white Americans, since that's the way it's been defined, would welcome hearing. And if I don't know any group of people who would love to hear that they're becoming part of a minority in their own country. So that if we really seriously undertook an effort to teach immigrants English, it would also send a signal to large numbers of non-immigrant Americans that at least their language is being valued and being sustained and reinforced. And I don't think that would be a bad thing at all.
Well, what else would you recommend?
Well, I would also recommend that we implement serious programs about sanctioning employers who hire illegal immigrants, that we need to expand the E-Verify program, which is the computerized program that's in existence already and partially used. That would address undocumented immigration in the kind of serious way that we have not done. And I think we need to talk about shifting the balance away from the heavy, heavy reliance now we have on family unification and family-based migration, and shifting it toward a more skills-based orientation, which isn't to say all one or the other. It's a shifting from what now is predominantly family-based and heavily tilted toward immigrants from unskilled, relatively uneducated backgrounds, and tilting it more toward more highly educated immigrants who would almost certainly pose fewer social challenges to America than the less educated, more socially disadvantaged immigrants that we've been receiving for the last 30 years.
I think those are all great suggestions. In the time that's left, would you like to say anything about one or both of the chapters you have in Debating Immigration?
Oh, well, sure. One of the chapters that I wrote with my colleague Noah Pickus, entitled Good Neighbors and Good Citizens, makes a point that I think is important to bear in mind, which is that so much of the debate over immigration for the last couple of decades is focused on illegal immigration, whether immigrants are here legally or not. And I don't discount that that's a matter of importance. But I also think that much of the anxiety and disaffection that many Americans have had with regard to the influx of immigrants has to do with the fact that there, when you introduce large numbers of newcomers into a society, particularly if they're not very advantaged, they pose all sorts of social challenges.
Right.
They create a certain amount of social change and even social disorder. If you're familiar with the argument over broken windows in questions of domestic law enforcement, in a way, it's analogous when you have large numbers of newcomers coming in who, as we've had, who don't speak the language, are struggling economically, socially, and that creates social strain and social disorder.
Right.
Doesn't mean that large numbers of immigrants are criminals or committing, even illegal immigrants aren't necessarily committing, serious crimes. Being here illegally is a misdemeanor. But it's a question of sort of the social strains that result. And we can see those social strains, by the way, playing out in Tijuana right now.
Right.
Among Mexicans who are experiencing the influx of all these migrants from part south. These are not to be unexpected, these kinds of social strains, but we tend not to want to own up to them. We want to reject them, reduce them to racism, which I think is too simplistic by far and unfair. Either that, or we want to just simply look at the legal status of immigrants, which is not unimportant. But I don't think that explains all of why so many Americans have gotten so riled up about our immigration policies. I think the dislocations and the disruptions and the social strains that are attendant upon what we've seen are a big part of it, and need to be understood as such and addressed as such.
And for people that want to know more about that, they have to purchase the book and read the chapter.
Definitely. And not just my chapter, but the other chapters in the book, which are make for one of the better, if not best, collections of essays on immigration policy that I'm aware of.
Well, I hope that you're wrong about the likelihood of reform during this Trump administration.
And, yes. And
so I'm hoping that we and some of the contributors to the volume will get an opportunity to speak to people in the Trump administration about what they need to do to work with Congress to reform some aspects of immigration.
I agree with you insofar as that I'm not pleased with my own forecast. But I certainly also agree with you that it's a time when we really need to have serious conversations and discussions about what needs to be done. And on that point, we can agree. And I know you and I will continue to talk about these things. Just hope that we can broaden the circle and bring in others who are serious-minded and want to address what is really clearly one of the more pressing problems that's on the agenda right now.
Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us today. And so, folks, you've heard it. You know more about immigration now than probably you wanted to know, but you have some ideas about what needs to be done. And until next time, remember that we the people can be the people who change America and our world.